All right, well, let's go through Revelation 17. John's describing again and again. Remember, he pops up over the clouds, and he's looking, and he sees these amazing things. And he sees what he called before Sodom and Egypt in chapter 11, in chapter 14. And Babylon was the old name. And there was a tower that was built back in the beginning of the Bible, just before Abraham. And that was the Tower of Babel. And at that place, what was the sin that got God's attention so that he had to destroy the tower and separate the people? What was their sin? Well, they wanted to replace God. So they said, we'll be like God. Nimrod had done that earlier in Genesis, and he was the builder of the city of Babel. Opposition to God is nicknamed Babel, which is the Hebrew word which translates confusion. We even say that, oh, stop babbling. It's the literal transliteration of the word. Now, that is informing John in his speech, in his writing. And he comes again now with another angle. So it was Sodom, which was the place of people's horrible sin of homosexuality and rejection of the guests who came, both sinned. And Egypt, of course, what they had done to the Jewish people is well known as enslaving and, again, rejecting God and saying, we'll be God, thanks very much. That's the sin that's constantly reflected throughout, not just Revelation, not just Isaiah, but throughout the whole record of Scripture. The sin is breaking the first commandment. So that's number one. If that sin, if that commandment is disregarded, then something else is going to take the place of God. What do we call that thing?
Idolatry.
It's an idol. That's right. So idolatry is the greatest sin on the planet. Yeah. And what is that? That's in one way, it's an active sin of accepting something else, but it's also a negative sin of rejecting the love of God, the peace of God, the pleasure of God, the belief in God. So idolatry is adultery on a spiritual level. Here is faith in God. That's what he wants. Here's God. He wants a relationship with us. He loves us. He says, come to me. And then we say, tell you what, I'm going to go over here to Babel. I'm going to be confused. I'm going to enter into a relationship, adulterous relationship with another deity. And that'll work instead of God. And that deity is often ourselves or things of our own making. And that's what he's been saying over and over. He's going to say it again tonight with this imagery of a harlot, an adulteress. I love the King James, the whore Babylon. Mm-hmm. It is so raw. All right, so one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and spoke with me. Again, complete number of angels, complete number of bowls, complete judgment that's going to fall on the world so that the New Jerusalem can come. So last week we ended chapter 15 and 16, talks about real raw evil. Now we get the judgment on evil such that we can have now the clean new Jerusalem come down and start all over. Okay. Come here, he says, and I'll show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters. It's an odd phrase, sits on many waters. So this is the characterization of someone who is consummate evil. It is subsumed in evil. God doesn't have a real problem with sex. He rather enjoys it. He gave it to us to enjoy, but he wants it within a certain confine. And when we go outside of that, that's when we get in trouble. So he has husband, wife. He even describes himself as the husband and we the bride of Messiah. Somehow we're the bride. We're going to see that in chapter 19 in a couple weeks. This idea of God's love to us in a real, in a marital way. So he's not opposed to that. He's opposed to it being done outside the realms of propriety. So this is the great city that rules over the kings of the earth and who sits on many waters. That phrase, sits on many waters, triggered something in me. And I think I found this verse in Jeremiah 51, which I think you'll like. It comes up over and over in this passage. There seem to be reflections of it. So somebody find that verse, would you please? Israel has always been God's passionate people. And the grafted in Gentiles into the Commonwealth of Israel are now part of that summary of the bride. Israel, all Jews? No, it's never been that. It's always been a remnant within Israel, that is Israel. So he has to be faithful to Israel. That's why there are always Jews who believe in Yeshua. It's not just a token one or two. I mean, there are tens of thousands of us today, 150,000, maybe even more. So this idea of the Commonwealth of Israel is certainly Jewish people and a Jewish matrix. At the same time, there are those who are grafted in to the olive tree who are Gentiles. And together, Jew and Gentile are the bride of Messiah. All right, Jeremiah 51:1 says this. Thus says the Lord, behold, I'm going to arouse against Babylon and against the inhabitants of Lev Hamai, the spirit of a destroyer. I will dispatch foreigners to Babylon that they may winnow her and may devastate her land. For on every side they will be opposed to her in the day of her calamity. Let not him who bends his bow bend it, nor let him rise up in his scale armor. So do not spare her young men. Devote all her army to destruction. They will fall down slain in the land of the Chaldeans and pierce through in their streets. For neither Israel nor Judah has been forsaken by his God, the Lord of hosts, although their land is full of guilt before the Holy One of Israel. Flee from the midst of Babylon, and each of you save his life. Don't be destroyed in her punishment, for this is the Lord's time of vengeance. He's going to render recompense to her. Babylon has been a golden cup in the hand of the Lord, intoxicating, getting drunk, all the earth. The nations have drunk of her wine, therefore the nations are going mad. Suddenly, Babylon has fallen and been broken. Wail over her. Bring balm for her pain, healing. Perhaps she may be healed. We applied healing to Babylon, but she was not healed. Forsake her. Let each of us go to his own country, for her judgment has reached to heaven and towers up to the very skies. The Lord has brought about our vindication. Come, let us recount in Zion the work of the Lord our God. Sharpen the arrows, fill the quivers. The Lord has aroused the spirit of the kings of the Medes, because his purpose is against Babylon to destroy it. For it is the vengeance of the Lord, vengeance for his temple. Here it is. Lift up a signal against the walls of Babylon. Post a strong guard. Station sentries. Place men in ambush. For the Lord has both purposed and performed what he spoke concerning the inhabitants of Babylon. O you who dwell by many waters, abundant in treasures, your end has come, the measure of your end. The Lord has sworn it by himself. Surely I will fill you with a population like locusts, and they will cry out with shouts of victory over you. Chapter 51 of Jeremiah is a declaration against Babylon in Jeremiah's day and against the Babylon in the book of the Revelation and against the Babylon in our day as well. It is so clear that God's judgment will fall on those who harm us. Now, where'd she sit? On many waters. So if you sit on many waters, it means you oversee the naval situation, which was the place of war in those days, place of commerce. So if you run the waters, then people can't get their ships in with all their goods to their people. It implies political and economic and military power. This, therefore, was the, if you will, United States of the day. The most military occupying, the strongest, the richest, and therefore the most responsible. And if we don't behave properly, God says, I'm going to judge you. The great harlot sits on many waters. So this I get a picture of, that this superpower, this super evil power, is one whom John identifies as this great city. I think it's a clear reference to Rome in its day. Rome not only was the great power of the day politically, but certainly militarily and certainly economically. They built the roads. They built the aqueducts. With whom the kings of the earth committed acts of immorality, and those who dwell in the earth were made drunk with the wine of her immorality. Chapter 17 of Revelation, verse 2. And there again, that picture of getting drunk with the wine. She had the cup in her hand that Jeremiah said. And he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast. It's the same woman. So now she's not only overseeing all the waters, she's now in the wilderness, which is a characterization of who and where we are as sojourners in our travels. Yeah, the world in which we find ourselves, wherever we are. Scarlet beast, full of blasphemous names, verse 3, having 7 heads and 10 horns. So again, this picture, we've seen it before, of 7 heads, 10 horns. 7 and 10 is the number of completion. So all governments, all self-trumpeting heads, meaning governmental heads, military heads, you get the picture. I thought of the word kepi. You know, we used to call it, you want, it's the Yiddish for a little head. Oh, is your kepi hurting? You know, you would say to a little bubbly, you know, you'd say to a little baby. And it comes from the German, of course, Kopf. But where does that come from? Strangely, from the Latin, yeah. Not Greek. The Latin of caput, from where we get captain. So the head is, of course, like the Rosh Yeshiva, the head of the yeshiva, Rosh Hashanah, the head of the year. Anyway, just some wandering thoughts today. The 7 heads are 7, the complete number of these governmental strengths. And, I mean, you can get the visual. It's pretty amazing. I can just see this woman. I can see the beast, and she's riding on it, and he's riding on it, like pulling all these Roman horses and stuff. It's a pretty amazing picture. I'd love to see this in video form one day. So yeah, these are evil people who are filled with evil and spirit of Jezebel. Sure, that's that. Blasphemous names, verse 3. That's, again, a transliteration of the word directly, blasfemo. Yeah.
Blastima.
To deride, to defame, to dishonor, to denigrate the name of something. In this case, the name of God.
Yeah.
And how do you do that? By one of two things I described at the beginning. You either reject faith in him, or you accept a foreign god and turn and spit on the name of God. But what it really boils down to is accepting as something less the standard of God. So here's God. He's at 7. Blasphemy is 6. You know, you just say, yeah, that'll do. No, God is God. Let everything else be found a lie. He's the truth. And when we say, well, that God's pretty good and that God's pretty good. No, they're false gods. Every God that rises up and claims to be God is not God. There's only one God. And as a result, we have to be almost ruthless with blasphemy to make God's name pedestrian.
Yes, that's it. That's it.
To make him who is exalted into just some ordinary word. Well, we don't do... I mean, think about it. You hit your finger with a... You close the door, and your finger gets caught in it, you don't say, oh, Buddha. Oh, Mohammed. You know, you say, oh, Jesus. You know, people do that. Yeah. Why do they do that? Oh. All right, verse 4. The woman was clothed in purple and scarlet, adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls. She's got a lot of stuff on. She's adorned well as a result of this. Some Christian women think that they shouldn't be adorned at all, because if you adorn yourself, you're like them. You're seducing other people. No, I think people just should look nice. There's nothing wrong with looking nice. That's the problem, is not that she's wearing gold. It's not the thing. It's the adoration of the thing. Having in her hand a gold cup full of abominations and of the unclean things of her immorality. So this is a description of her rejection of God, not that she's adorned. The adornment is not wrong. But she's got the cup. That's the Jeremiah reference again. And on her forehead, a name was written, Musterion, a mystery. Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. So this is the summary of who this, what some call I don't know why people do it, but they make this into a false church. There are some believers out there who say that Babylon represents the church that goes away from God. I don't know why they do that. There's nothing in here that indicates that it is related to religion. It really is related to military politics and economy. It's a substitute for the real God, and that's what you want to see. Not particularized in religion, I don't think. But there are religions that do wrong, as you describe. Again, a political machine that serves, and we'll get to that in a moment. I saw the woman, verse 6, drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the witnesses of Yeshua. So wait a minute, what's the difference between the blood of the saints and the blood of the witnesses? Well, blood of the saints are the ones who are still alive, like John, who's writing, who's suffering, who's in exile, and so many others who've been hurt and damaged but are in prison. So the witnesses are those who have perished already. They've died for the faith. And like you said, Orit, the lions have eaten some of us. Yep. We've been fed to them in the Colosseums because of the faith. Yeah, they were given a choice to accept Nero or, I mean, he was the worst. At the time of John's writing in the 90s, long before Constantine in the 4th century, Nero was the bad guy. For every Jew living today, whom would it be to whom we point? To whom would we point? Is the worst guy? Hitler.
Yeah.
Yeah. He would be the Hitler of the day, would be Emperor Nero, the most evil. So she had the kings, and she had the... This is interesting to me. The woman... Where are the kings? Verse 2, the kings of the earth committed acts with her and dwelled with her, and the woman was drunk with the blood of the saints. So I see two things going on here. One is this political notion, the kings of the earth, and she's gaining ascendancy with them. And the religion, she's really just known as an anti-religious person. She's killing saints, and she's hurting and damaging real people who really want to walk with God. Rome continues to seduce the rulers of the world to trade with her, regardless of the best interest of the citizens wherever they were, whether in China or in Egypt or wherever. Rome was dominating in that way. And she's going to just make everybody submit to her power. That's where she gets she's drunk with the blood. And so I wondered, John said, this is an interesting phrase, isn't it? Verse 6 at the end. When I saw her, I wondered. With the word for miracle there, Thelma.
I wondered greatly.
I wondered what's going on here. And the angel said to me, why do you wonder? I'll tell you. I'll tell you what's going on. So in other words, don't scratch your head. This is pretty clear, and I'm going to make it clearer every time we go through this. The mystery of the woman and the beast that carries her, which has the 7 heads and the 10 horns. The beast that you saw is not, and is about to come out of the abyss, go to destruction. So this idea of was, isn't, and will be is probably, John had in mind the multitude of believers that were slaughtered under Nero, but there was talk that Nero and others who were and were no longer were going to actually come back. Let me see if I can find this. The emperor had 7 heads and 10 horns. They actually painted, I mean, they had scene with that. They had statues with that. I want to look at Nahum chapter 3, verse 4. Chapter 3, verse 4. All because of the many harlotries of the harlot, the charming one, the mistress of sorceries, who sells nations by her harlotries and families by her sorceries. Nahum is citing again this kind of image of seduction that takes Jewish people away from not husbands, but from God.
The worship of God.
And the image of a harlot is seductive. We see it in Proverbs. We see it throughout Proverbs. And who would know better than that? than Solomon.
Yeah,
Solomon knew well the seduction of many women, hundreds of women. I don't know how he kept up. So that I just want that to inform us. Look, John is using this idea. He portrays Nero or Domitian, who ruled 81 to 96 of the Common Era, as this king who is, that is, he was, he is not, and he will come again. So it's the same as Yeshua, isn't it? Yeshua who was, he was incarnate, he lived among us. He is not because he not only died and rose, but he ascended. So he's not with us today. Yeshua is up in heaven.
Yeah.
And he will, parousia, he will come again in his appearing. So this false God and false religion and false politics and false everything, the idols of the world, this adulteress, is almost the same as Yeshua. It's copying the style of and the power of and the life of Yeshua, so that Nero, who was around from, when was his era? I'll get his exact dates. Around AD 64. And Titus, of course, took over. Well, so Nero, then Vespasian, who was in charge at the time of the destruction of the temple, though Titus came and did it. And then Titus, who came and ruled from 79 to 81. Then Domitian, and he was probably the worst.
Domitian.
Yeah. He was actually nicknamed Nero Incarnate. So when John is writing, which is the time of Domitian, he's saying the one who was Nero is not, because he's gone, and will come again. That's this great-great-grandson, if you will, this horrible, evil man. Whatever bad, I mean, we use Hitler, Stalin. If we lived in Russia, we would have no problem identifying the worst person of the 20th century with Stalin. Napoleon, if we lived in the 19th century, what he did to his own people, what he did to others with whom he fought.
Yes.
So it really depends on what era we are to say, oh, this is the worst guy ever, only because we understand it. So this one came out of the abyss, isn't that what it says?
Yeah.
Yeah, verse 8, out of the abyss and is going to destruction. This is so different than Yeshua, who came out of heaven and was born in a manger. This is the dark one who comes up. And you get a picture of every Batman episode or Superman episode or something. Where's this bubbling, dark, Neptune-like sea, and out from it comes this dark creature. We tend to think in those sci-fi things, but this was real. Those who dwell on the earth whose name had not been found written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, verse 8, will wonder, and that's the same word, when they see the beast that he was, is not, and will come. Those whose names are not written in the book of life. Now, when do we talk about the book of life as Jews?
Yom Kippur.
Rosh Hashanah.
Well, during the 10 days. We talk about it during Aseret Yemei Teshuvah. So we think that our names should be written in the book of life. It's sealed and then finally all wrapped up on Hoshana Rabbah, you know, at the end of Sukkot. So we've got 22 days to make sure our name is in the book of life. But John here is saying, your name's already written in the book of life. And it's not an annually renewable contract. It is a permanent thing. And these people who are worshiping the wrong beast, who are worshiping the wrong God, and every generation has a Babylon, every generation has a beast, every generation has Yeshua, and every generation there are people who are going to be filling the cup of the harlot with the blood of saints and the blood of martyrs. Every generation is going to have people who fulfill some of these categories. And if we dismiss this and say, oh, this will happen later, or if we dismiss it and say, oh, this already happened, then we miss the very point that God wants to encourage us and lift our spirits, that God wants to help us to hang in there to the end. Exactly.
Right.
verse 9, here's the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. And those, of course, Rome had seven hills around
it. That's right.
It's the city of seven hills. But also, what was the nickname for Rome? The eternal city. Eternal city. And if it's an eternal city, that means it always was and always will be. But behold, it's just one of many cities. So here's John having a go at Rome, thinking itself eternal, when he says, you're just like the others who came before. Not Augustus, Tiberius, Gaius, Claudius, Nero, Vespasian. He's talking about Babylon. He's talking about, Egypt, number two, Assyria, number three, Babylon, number four, Persia, number five, Greece. You're number six, Rome, and you're not going to last forever either. Yeah. So those are the seven kings. Five have fallen, I just listed, Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, Greece. One is, that's Rome, and the other has not yet come, and when he comes, he must remain a little while. That whole idea of a little while is to encourage us. If it's only going to last a little while, hang in there, brothers and sisters.
Yeah, very good.
Now, when you think about that, how long was a little while? How long was Rome in charge? Really, Pax Romana lasted well into the...
600 years?
No, not that long. But well into the 3rd century, where Rome was the dominant force, and there was no real problem from outside or from inside. They basically just ran a smooth ship, and everything was fine. So when he says, you're going down, you're going to fall, Babylon, buckle your seatbelt, you're going into the sea. If you would have been reading this in 150 A.D., you'd have said, well, I don't know if John was right, because Rome was still running things, and Christians were still being killed, and Jews were still scattered, but it's only for a little while. Verse 11, the beast which was and is not is himself also an eighth and is one of the seven, and he goes to destruction. So there's the government that is represented by Rome. It isn't Rome, but it's represented by this whole, what we call the world system, the world
system.
And it is the United Nations, as we've described. It's the EU, as we've described. It's the Trilateral Commission, the Illuminati. Not all interfaith things are wrong. But when interfaith becomes non-faith, then it's wrong. If they allow, for instance, there's a book over here called The Christian and the Pharisee, written by a rabbi and a Christian pastor. And they are both as forthright in their beliefs as they could be. It's a series of letters from one to the other to the one to the other. Beautiful. Well done. Neither convinces the other, but they're both honest and forthright about who they are and what they believe. That's interfaith. But when it's non-faith and they say, look, let's all get along at whatever cost, then that's not faith at all. That's mush. And it's really unison and not harmony. It is a slew of despond, and it's not anything for any believer in which to participate, I don't think. All right, I don't want to get bogged here. Let's go. Seven kings. The beast, verse 11, we got him. Verse 12, the ten horns which you saw are ten kings who have not yet received a kingdom. But they receive authority as kings with the beast, here it is again, for 1 hour.
1 hour.
Now, who are these people? These are governmental little guys who pop up, who like bolster the beast. So there's a symbiosis, a mutualism that occurs between these little kings who give ascendancy to the beast and therefore over also to Babylon. And then they get rewarded. So the beast then says, hey, good on you. You get to be governor over 40, you know, and... So you get a king of East Africa, or a king of Somalia, to be particular, or a king of Iraq that then gives power to some of its provincial leaders. You get ISIS, who are nobody, but they're one of these kings who are arising in our day. They have no power, no rights, no nothing, but all of a sudden the world notices them, and they have these dominant moments. So these have one purpose, and they give their power and authority to the beast. So it's mutualism. The beast gives them power, they give their power to the beast, and everybody's happy except for the believers who cop it from both sides. Okay? and they wage war against the Lamb, verse 14, and the Lamb will overcome them. So their fight, whether it's military, whether it's political, my goodness, you'd have to be blind to see that believers are in a battle today, that there's not a war by politicians everywhere, whether it's in Victoria or New South Wales, or it's in Saudi Arabia, where you couldn't carry this Bible you're reading into Saudi Arabia. I don't know what they do with smartphones. You know, everybody's got them. I honestly don't know if they'd... I haven't been there. I flew Emirates for the first time the other night.
Lovely.
Because I missed my Qantas flight. But 2 hours later, I got on Emirates. And I wondered, should I... So I put my Bible program on and opened it up. Aftzalachas. You know, I just wanted to see it, just to stir things up. In case somebody came, I'm sorry, sir, you can't read your Bible. I just wanted somebody to... But they wouldn't. They wouldn't know, flying from Singapore to Melbourne. But there are places where governments have said believers can't operate in freedom. Certainly China, my oh my, all across China. And so they're waging war against believers. Whether it's physical and the beheading, I mean, we saw that in Kenya just a few weeks ago at the university, where those 140 students were summarily killed just because they were believers in Jesus. Just it, boom, killed. Or whether that you're derided in some minor level. It certainly doesn't sound the same as a battle of heads and no heads. But there is a battle that is seeking to erode the strength of believers in public. This marginalization of belief and believers, almost where you look at television and you look at movies, and every believer who is clearly identified as a believer is a Ned on Simpsons, kind of a nerdy guy, and kind of a dweeb. Something about faith that's to be ridiculed and mocked, that's the beginning of the full orb war against the king, against the Lamb. King of Kings, Lord of Lords. I like that phrase. We're going to see it again in chapter 19. We'll talk about it then. And those who are with him. Look at that. What a great phrase in verse 14. The war is against the Lord and against those who are with him, who are the called, the chosen, and the faithful. Reliable, trustworthy. That's us. He said to me, the waters, those are all the nations. Again, the number four, you see it. Peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. Four different groups, but that just means the lot. The comprehensive global system is opposed to the Messiah. And he says that's where she's sitting on the waters. The ten horns and the beast, they will hate the harlot. So now there, the world system is going to turn on a particular part of it, which is, I think, why some say that's the church, and will make her desolate, naked, eat her flesh, and burn her up with fire. We're going to get to come out of her next week. Mm-hmm. This idea, Ezra chapter 9 says that the world, that we're embarrassed at seeing this, and we ought to come out from her. God's going to bring in the new Jerusalem, the city prepared for us. And so this is the removal of one and the putting in place of another. During John's prophecy, Imperial Rome is remarkable because there is no conflict from outside or inside. Rome was at the height of her powers, no serious threat on her frontiers or any uprising from inside. Pirates had been cleared from the seas, and elegant cities dotted the shores of the Mediterranean and were to be found in many inland regions as well. Then Domitian would fall, and the empire would enter the golden years of five good emperors: Nerva, Trajan, Hadrian, we know that name, Antonius Pius, and Marcus Aurelius, who went on till 180 AD. Remember what they wanted to do. Rome had made itself a name. Pax Romana. It wasn't just called Pax, the peace. It was Roman peace. It's exactly what we said at the beginning. It's the Tower of Babel. They made a name for themselves, and as a result, God had to come in and smush it. He didn't smush it immediately. He's trying to destroy it, and why does he do that? Look, this weekend is Shavuot. And what do we do on Shavuot? What did they do in Acts chapter 2 when the Newer Testament people took it on board? They began to, they were filled with the Spirit and spoke in tongues. And the last time a whole group had spoken in odd languages was the Tower of Babel. Tower of Babel evidenced unity for the wrong sake. Shavuot in the Newer Testament emphasizes unity for God's sake. Mm-hmm. And he pours out his Spirit, and they all spoke in odd languages to his praise and to the declaration of his purposes among the people. What Babel evidenced in confusion, Shavuot evidences in the praise of God, that it is all the language. Languages aren't the problem. It was what it was used for. So in the same way, all of what we're saying here, this notion of Babel, portrayed as proud, Satan-like being who aspires to be equal with God, saying, I will be like God. Isaiah 14 says that. It's blasphemous. God says no. Isaiah 47, verse 8, I am, there is no one else beside me. That's the name that these people were taking for themselves. Yeshua said, nope, I'm God, you're not. So this great city which reigns over the kings, she's going to fall next week. That's chapter 17 of Revelation.